Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
Jeff Strong is a believer, an all-in Latter-day Saint. Active is the word used in the culture. So bishop, mission president, taught at BYU. And he's written a book built around the findings of a wide-ranging study of why people are leaving his church. And here's the headline number. Roughly 40% of formerly active members in the United States have stepped away over the last 25 years. Now, we should be clear, his study isn't a fully representative statistical sample, but it does line up with other national studies that have found similar numbers and patterns in Mormon participation trends. And the statistic is personal for Strong, as you'll hear. In the book, he's trying to understand the basics. How many are leaving, and why did they go? And he thinks he understands why. He doesn't think it's about disagreements over doctrine or church history, though, of course, those are deeply troubling for some and absolutely contributes to people leaving. But Strong says the reason people are leaving is the culture, what he calls the habits and traditions, the unspoken expectations of a community that worships together week after week. He says people are torn between their personal sense of faith and integrity and their desire to belong to the church. That's the central tension, a conflict between the personal and the institutional. And the book is full of insights that go beyond truth claims and into whether people are just trying to live out basic Christian principles in their own lives. As Strong puts it, sometimes it's less about whether the church is true and more about whether I can survive this. And he begins the book with news that he got from the first of the three of his five children who have left the faith. It was a note from his son, Cale, who had just left for his mission.
My normal routine when I stagger out of bed every morning is I usually stumble into my office while I'm rubbing the sleep out of my eyes, and I hit email to see if anything is urgent or important. A little over 13 years ago, there was an email from Cale. He had just gone into the MTC a few days earlier, and he said he was coming home. Kind of reading between the lines, I could tell that he was probably going to end his relationship and participation in the church. I sort of felt myself going numb. It was unbelievable to me. We saw him as immature, selfish, and making a decision that would damage the rest of his life. Many in our Latter-day Saint community saw it the same way. We all felt the need to fix him, but every conversation pushed him further away. Very discouraged and kind of praying for a way forward, I got on a flight for a business trip to the East Coast, and midair there was a medical emergency that forced us to land in Kansas City. And as we waited, the man beside me showed me a photo album with page after page of breathtaking black and white photographs of falcons. He was a falconer. I knew nothing about falconry. I asked him what he knew about falcons that most people wouldn't know. Without hesitation, he said, "They don't have to come back. When you release them, they're completely free. They return only if they want to. If they feel anger, disappointment, or frustration from me, they don't come back." As he spoke, I could not take my eyes off the photographs of those astonishing, powerful, sensitive creatures. And something in me broke open. I felt God showing me my son. Kel was not broken. He was not rebellious. He was not lost. He was a falcon, intelligent, beautiful, sensitive, free, wounded, and now gone. I suddenly understood what I could not see. I had mistaken stewardship for ownership, help for control, love for rescue. The tighter I tried to hold him, the farther he needed to fly. I sat there, undone. For the first time in a long time, I realized Kale's journey was not mine to manage. My role was not to correct him. If I wanted my son to return, I needed to be a person he would want to return to. Receptive soil instead of hard and unyielding ground. A well of living water, not a stone of expectation. That moment became a hinge point in my life. It changed how I listened. It changed how I spoke. It changed how I saw my son and myself. And looking back on that conversation with him, I finally understood how high the stakes had been and how unprepared I was to have the most important conversations of his life. Literally that same summer, there were families in our ward stepping away. And I had this narrative in my head of, yes, of course people are leaving. They've always left. It's those people, you know, the ones that lack the faith and character to be Latter-day Saints. And they wash out. But Kale didn't fit that profile. And these families in my ward didn't fit that profile. So I had a hard time letting it go. I just said, look, there's this narrative that disaffiliation is rare and it's of a particular type of person. And the reality I'm seeing is it's becoming increasingly common and it's not that type of person. And something here is wrong. That was a gradual awakening for me where I realized, wow, this is not an isolated thing. This is broad and prolific and affecting people of all kinds. And the prevailing narrative in the community is not accurate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jeff Strong's book is called Torn, and he's our guest for the hour.
As best I can tell from my research and very credible research done by Pew and Harvard and the University of Chicago, all of those studies would suggest that an approximate estimate for how many Latter-day Saints have stepped away over the last quarter century is about 40%. I don't think there's ever been a time where we've had disaffiliation of that magnitude. And the data, to me, when you look at all the different independent research projects that confirm approximately the same number, it suggests the data is accurate.
You mention in the book, we'll dig into those numbers as we go, by the way, but you mention in the book that there are these conflicting narratives. On one hand, the church is collapsing. The other narrative is the church is great. It's thriving. Church members say we had more convert baptisms last year than in a long time or something. Talk a little bit about these competing narratives and how you make sense of them.
You know, it's a really, really good question because I think your average member of the LDS community, whether you're out of the church or you're in the church, you're still part of the community, it would be really easy to be confused by these conflicting messages. And so when you actually dig into what's happening, there is no conflict in the messages, but both the message of total demise and the message of total prosperity are inaccurate. So what is happening is the church continues to convert people, and 2025 was the largest number of convert baptisms on record for the entire history of the church, just over 389,000 convert baptisms. And 2024 was also a very good year, about 309,000, I think, which was the largest year since 1997. And so people continue to join the church. They continue to join the church in relatively large numbers. And based on the best data that I've seen, the church continues to grow modestly. But simultaneously with that, people are also leaving, right? So if you think about a simple metaphor of a bucket of water, there is water coming in the top, and there is water leaking out of the bottom. And the net of that is the level of water is very slightly rising in the bucket, but not nearly as much as the rapid growth and prosperity narrative would suggest.
So, as the title of the book implies, believing Latter-day Saints, you say, feel torn. And I wanted you to sort of explain this conflict. You write that they're torn between, and this is how you put it, torn between their personal faith and integrity on one hand, and between that and then on the other side is their desire to belong to and be faithful to the church. So if I get it right, that conflict here is one side that is personal, the other side is kind of institutional. They're torn between their image of faith and devotion, their own image, and then the church's. How do you understand it? Am I getting that
right?
Yeah,
look, I think you framed that really well. I'd use slightly different labels, but the same framing. I think part of the tearing is belief, and part of the tearing is relational. You might have somebody, for example, that encounters very problematic church history information that causes a tremendous amount of intellectual dissonance in them.
Yeah.
And so they're encountering that. It's creating incredible conflict for them because they're having a hard time reconciling that with the way they were taught about the church's history throughout their lifetime. And the tension is the fact that that information is pulling them away from belief in the church, but this is an institution and a community they've been loyal to and participated in for their entire life. And so that's the part that's torn in them is, am I going to be led by the information I'm reading that's challenged my belief, or am I going to be led more by my sense of connection to the community and my desire to continue to affiliate with a community that's been very good to me for a long time? So that's kind of the belief side or institutional side. But the other side is perhaps even more problematic, and that's relational. So it's being a parent and seeing your child leave the church and feeling torn by that, or being a child and leaving the church and feeling estranged from your parents because things that you once held in common are no longer there.
Yeah.
It might be because you're in a mixed-faith marriage, and Doug, in the past, a mixed-faith marriage might be a Latter-day Saint and a Catholic, or a Catholic and an evangelical. Well, now you have two Latter-day Saints, one believing, one non-believing.
Yeah, one goes on Sunday, one doesn't.
Yeah, and that can create great tension in the relationship,
yeah,
or at least complexity that a couple has to figure out how to manage. And then sometimes friendships change or even end over this. And so whether you're torn because you're battling with your long-term loyalty and love for the church relative to new information that changed the way you believe, or whether you're being torn by relationship difficulties, I think torn is a really apt word for our moment.
You say it's more than an individual faith crisis. You say it's a trust crisis, a trust crisis between a people and their church.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And for decades, it's been framed as a faith crisis. And I think that's been incorrect from the beginning. And it actually contributes to the misperceptions that, you know, I'm an active believing Latter-day Saint, and many of my friends are, although many are out. And I think calling it a faith crisis mischaracterizes it and contributes to the misunderstanding. Far more often, it's a trust crisis. I'll just give you an example. So what happens when someone goes through a faith transition? Our research suggested there are four phases. And I'll just briefly talk about each of the four, and it kind of leads you to the conclusion that trust at the end of the day is the biggest issue. So the first phase is some kind of integrity disruption, and it might be new information about church history, or it might be encountering a conflict between what your personal values are about how people should be treated and how the institutional church is treating people. So, for example, maybe somebody with an alternate sexual identity. And the net effect of this first phase is your conscience is stirred and you're troubled. The second phase is you give yourself permission to ask questions that in the past you didn't ask because they felt scary or disloyal to you. And the dissonance that you're feeling eventually forces you to confront those questions. And so you start asking tough questions. The third phase is intensive seeking. You're trying to answer those questions. And this phase can last for years. It can involve a tremendous amount of emotion and energy. And what I've seen in the research and the people that I've interviewed is there's an overwhelming bias for people to resolve the questions and stay in the church. But ultimately, they get to stage four. And in stage four, if the transition and search that they've undertaken is met with honesty, accountability, openness, transparency, support, encouragement, friendship, love. Often they'll stay in the church in spite of what they might believe. But if it's met with defensiveness or criticism or correction or indifference or withdrawal, the fourth phase is relational breaking. And so trust and belonging stop. And so I'll give you a simple example. If somebody encounters problematic church history information, which is the most common reason people cite for leaving, it might disrupt their faith in Joseph Smith, for example, or the Book of Mormon, or maybe the church as an institution, but it doesn't necessarily disrupt their faith in God or faith in Jesus Christ or their desire to live the gospel. So to me, calling that a faith crisis is probably not correct. And then ultimately, if they have this relational breaking experience, it's their sense of trust and belonging that's broken, not faith. And so many of them leave and they continue to be believers. They just don't believe in the narrative of the restoration or perhaps in the mission of the church as a steward of faith and belief. And to me, a much better phrase than faith crisis is trust crisis. They no longer feel like they can trust the institution to be a steward of faith, and they no longer feel a sense of belonging in a community where people see that as an expectation.
So just so I'm getting this right, and we'll dig into the particulars here in a second, but you don't think this is mostly because they don't believe in the church. It's just that they don't feel like they belong in the church or they don't fit. Is that right?
Well, I think I would say it a little bit differently, Doug. I think our data suggests that when people go through faith transition, for many of them, their belief in God is strengthened, but their belief in the church is severely weakened.
Yeah.
That's a little more complex than just calling it a faith crisis. So I would say there's a trust crisis because while they still may believe in God and even the gospel and the principles of the gospel, if church history or their perception that the church had an unchristlike position or policy on a social issue, that's a trust-breaking thing.
Right. Okay. So because it's hard to tease apart the idea of what it means to say the church is true or I believe in the church. Because let's take Joseph Smith, for example, and the idea that he translated the Book of Mormon from some golden plate, that whole story.
Yes.
So someone who believes that, believes in an essential element of the church, but then there's also an essential element of the church that says, you know, be kind to your neighbor.
Yes.
Treat the poor with care. You know, love one another. Eschew violence and don't judge people, all of those kinds of things. But in Mormonism, those things are packed together. So how do you tease them apart?
Yeah, no, that's so well said. So let's dive into that. So I use the term in trying to more accurately describe what happens to people is they no longer believe the church is what it claims to be. Now, what that means is a cornerstone of testimony in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the restoration narrative that Joseph Smith saw God the Father and the Son in the sacred grove, that Moroni gave him the plates, that he translated the Book of Mormon by the gift of power of God, etc. Those are the church's truth claims that are attached to our belief that this is the only true and living church on earth and that we have God's authority via priesthood keys to administer the affairs of the church. That is what they lose their belief in, that the church's claim of those things is not true. But they don't necessarily lose their belief in the principles of the restored gospel, which you did a pretty good job of articulating, right? Many of them continue to be people of faith. They continue to try to seek and follow Jesus Christ or God in the best way they know how. Even people that disconnect from institutional religion often retain many of the values that they got growing up in the church. And so what they let go of is they let go of much of the history. They let go of much of the culture that they didn't see as being true or good. But they certainly hold on to many of the values, principles, and beliefs that they think are good.
But aren't they being told by their leaders? that it can't work that way. It doesn't work that way. You can't separate the story of Joseph Smith and the history of the Book of Mormon from the Golden Rule or any of the other the Beatitudes of Jesus. They're connected. It doesn't work that way. You can't be a Mormon and believe like that.
Well, I think you just perfectly articulated why a loss of belief in what the church claims to be then quickly can become a crisis of belonging. There are many people who have left the church that encountered problematic information or social positions from the church very thoughtfully, sincerely, painfully, over a long period of time, evaluated how they wanted to think about those things and believe those things, eventually came to the conclusion that as a matter of integrity, I don't believe that the church is what it claims to be, but would still like to participate in the community. Now, there are some people in the post-Mormon community that would say, hey, for me, purely encountering information in church history that I believed was incorrect or misrepresented was enough. And when I learned that, I was out.
Yeah.
But that's often not true. People say, you know, I love the community. I love my fellow saints. The community has been good to me. I value the principles and the teaching. So I'd like to participate, but I'd sure like to do so honestly. So what happens, Doug, is if they choose to be a little bit transparent about their loss of some of those foundational beliefs, generally that doesn't go well in the church community. You know, you said it well, you know, the church leaders, it's not just leaders, but leaders and many members, there's an expectation that if you don't have those traditional Orthodox beliefs, you're not really a true Latter-day Saint. Now, when people feel that, that's what contributes to the sense that they don't belong.
Jeff Strong, his book is called Torn, Why People We Love Are Leaving the Church and What We Can Learn from Them. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. According to some recent studies, nearly half of formerly active Latter-day Saints in the United States over the last 25 years have stepped away from the church. So today in the program, we're talking with Jeff Strong, a former bishop and mission president who has written a book exploring why that's happening. Strong suggests it's driven as much by experience and culture as by belief. And he says it often comes down to this tension between the personal and the institutional. His book is called Torn. I want to talk about the research that informs the book so we can get to the data. You say it's the most in-depth study ever done on disaffiliation within the church. So the number you have come up with it is around 40%. 40% of once active, faithful members of the church in the U.S. have stopped participating over the past 25 years. Is this at all different from other trends you're seeing in other Christian faiths? I mean, we've all heard about the national trend of people leaving organized religion. Do Latter-day Saints fit in here, or is it distinctive or different?
Yeah, and so what's universally accepted is that there's significant disaffiliation happening in almost all institutional religions in the developed world, including the United States. And so there are some religions that are outliers that are not experiencing significant disaffiliation, but in general, all religions are experiencing significant disaffiliation. And Latter-day Saints certainly are not an exception to that. There is debate, and I don't think there's consensus, on whether Latter-day Saints are disaffiliating at the same rate as everyone else or at a faster or slower rate. And so there's a really good study done by Justin Dyer and other professors at BYU, and they show that Latter-day Saint retention appears to be higher in the absolute than most other religions. But there's conflicting data. So if you look at the Pew study, it would say Latter-day Saints retain at a higher rate, which I think is accurate, and that the rate of disaffiliation, in other words, the trend, is comparable to most other U.S. religions.
if you look at the Harvard Cooperative Election Study, it actually doesn't tell you whether Latter-day Saints are retaining at a higher or lower level, but it does show a trend versus other denominations, and it would suggest that we're disaffiliating at a faster rate than most other denominations in the United States.
Okay, so we talked about how many are leaving. Let's talk about who they are, those who are leaving. And there are a couple of things that I found really striking. And one of the things is, in response to the question of who they are, is that they're, as you say in the book, they're not members who have always been inactive. In other words, these are people who were highly active. They
Yes.
were all in, right?
Yeah, the way we ask the question in our survey is we first ask them, when you are participating at your highest level, how active were you? And so we gave them a scale. And anybody that said, I was very active or completely active, we designated them as having been fully active. We then asked that group, what's your status now? And that's where the disaffiliation numbers came from that I've given you. And so we asked it in different ways. We asked a direct question, are you still participating in the church? 42% said no. We asked them for an estimate of their two families. Doug, what I mean by two families is their immediate family and then their birth family. So in the case of Jeff Strong, my immediate family, 60% of my children, 3 out of 5 are out. And in my birth yeah. family, interestingly enough, in other words, the posterity of my parents, 61% are out. And then we asked them a third time. We said, thinking of your Latter-day Saint high school friends, what percent of them no longer participate? And that number was 47%. The two families number was 48%. So we conservatively rounded that down to 40% and then compared that to the Harvard and Pew studies, which were in the same general vicinity, and felt pretty comfortable with that estimate.
So they were all in. But the other thing that's interesting, you mention in the book that members of the church who were 35 years old and under were leaving at substantially higher rates. Now, that's something that I don't think will surprise very many people.
Right.
But this surprised me. You say members aged 66 and older are also leaving at faster than average rates. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a really good question. I'll tell you a story that just popped up this last week. So I get emails every day from people through the website of the book. And I was really delighted about a week ago. I got one from a man that I served when we were missionaries in Sydney, Australia in 1984. He and I were briefly companions. And so he sent me an email and he said, hey, it's Bill. I would love to talk. And I was thrilled because I haven't talked to him in over 40 years. He's now in his, he's 65 years old. And so literally yesterday, we got on the phone and spent a couple of hours together. And I'll just relay his story because I think it's typical of those that are older that are stepping away. So he was a convert to the church in his mid-teens, went on a mission at 19, and he was an incredible missionary. He was one of the most committed, passionate, idealistic missionaries in our entire mission. And as I talked to him about that yesterday, he just said, Jeff, I joined the church and I was absolutely inspired and captivated by this idea of being in the true church of Jesus Christ, literally restored to the earth, led by true and living prophets, and having an opportunity to participate in the building of Zion. And that was why I joined, and it was so exciting to me. And then I said, well, what happened? Because he's no longer participating.
Yeah.
And he said, over the last 40 years, my life experience in the church just didn't live up to that potential. And so as I got older and as I had more experience in the church community, the dream that I had, the promise that I saw, the potential that I believed in, it was just never realized, and at some point, the experience for me in the church became a bit performative and empty and unfulfilling, and so he chose to step away.
It sounds as though where he fits in terms of the categories you mentioned for why they leave is that spiritual depletion factor. And but hold off on that for a second. Let's talk about these reasons why they're leaving. This is an important part of the book. And I wanted to sort of go through these if we could. Let's begin with there are four waves, as you call them, of why people decide to leave. And this first one you cite in the book is lifestyle dissonance. People who figured that. Now, this is 6% of those who leave fit into this category. What is the lifestyle dissonance? The idea of, as someone told you, I couldn't keep living this way.
Yeah, you know, it's really pretty straightforward. And my belief is that this wave has been around probably for a long time. But it's a wave that's about depletion, not doubt. And so 34% of people say that the controlling culture was problematic for me. 29% said I felt mental health strain. 25% said I experienced guilt and shame. Others cited things like excess time demand, missionary pressure, in other words, pressure to do missionary work that they found uncomfortable. Yeah. And so this is a group of people where, you know, dedicated, faithful, active members of the church, but over time, the experience depletes them. And so they choose to step away. It's important, Doug, on this particular wave to cite, it's probably bigger than 6%, but there might be some selection bias here where people would say they might be uncomfortable picking that answer.
Yeah.
And so a critic would say, Jeff, you're probably understating this group. I agree with that. We don't know, but, you know, double it. Maybe it's 12%, even triple it to 18%. It doesn't really change the conversation we're having.
Well, it doesn't really change it. And also these overlap. So I think that's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that this particular one, this sort of wave of disaffiliation doesn't ask, is the church true? But can I survive the church? Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, I can give you two examples, both close to home. So when back in 2005, I was working for Procter & Gamble. My wife and I and our five children relocated as expats to Australia, where I ran the business there. You know, moving to an international city is very challenging, and we were dealing with the burden of that. But the ward we moved into was spectacular. Like we had an instant family day one, and it was so helpful in making that transition. But life was still complicated. Living in a big city, we had our kids scattered in schools all around the city, and I had a very demanding job. And my wife and I were just feeling overwhelmed, and so we stopped to do a little bit of an inventory on that. And I pulled out, you know, back in the day when we had paper state calendars, right, where we looked at a state calendar on paper. And I was counting the number of times my family left the home in 1 month in order to do church stuff. So it was early morning seminary in the morning and, you know, out and back in the morning, you know, mutual church leadership meetings, sacrament meetings, church activities, service projects. And as we tabulated the number of times we left our home, it was about 60 times per month. On top of a very demanding life in a big metro area in a foreign country. And so Sarah and I sat down and we said, we just can't sustain that. It's really wearing us out. Our children don't have any downtime. We don't have any downtime. We're getting tired. It's taking a toll on us emotionally. We were still very active. I was serving in a bishopric at the time, and I think she was the ward young women's president. But we started to be much more selective about our participation in church and non-church things because our family was feeling overwhelmed. That's a really good example of what people in this wave might be experiencing.
All right, let's talk about this other wave. And this is the largest wave. It's the main reason people seem to be stepping away from the church. And that is, and this is not going to surprise anyone, it's church history and truth claims.
Yes.
Here's something you write in the book. I want to read this. You say, for many, the deepest rupture is not learning of these troubling things. It's concluding they no longer know who or what to trust.
Yeah, and that's where the trust crisis thing emerges, right? So what's interesting to me about it is in all the people that I've interviewed, how forgiving many of them are of historical problems or mistakes, right? So they would say, well, I don't expect the church to be perfect. I don't expect church leaders to be perfect. But where that breaks down a little bit is if they encounter information where mistakes or problems occurred, but individuals or the institution weren't transparent or accountable about those issues. And then it moves from, well, I'm not sure if I believe the restoration happened, to can I trust the church to be the interpreter and messenger of the restoration narrative? And that makes it more complicated. In fact, distrusting how the church has handled church history problems is one of the biggest church history problems.
Yeah. They felt lied to in some cases, misled.
Yes. Yep. Yep. And, you know, I think one very prominent Latter-day Saint that I think everyone is familiar with is John DeLynn. And earlier this year, he did a podcast with Craig Madsen, who's a very active Orthodox member of the church. They actually got together and had a fabulous and thoughtful discussion. But Greg asked him some questions about his own faith transition. And John talked very poignantly about how painful it was for him to encounter church history information. And in John's case, he came to the conclusion that the church hadn't been transparent or perhaps had been dishonest. And he compared it to feeling like one of his parents had had an affair. And as I watched him talk about it, you could see that even though it's been almost 20 years, he still feels really deeply wounded by that. And so I think that's not atypical.
So the second largest wave, and a really important reason why people leave the church, is the church's social positions and a sense that they feel of moral conflict. This is the way the church deals with LGBTQ plus people. It's their financial stewardship is how you put it, but I think everyone knows what that means. Just the fact that they've got a lot of money and there are questions about the transparency with that and how they're spending it and why they need so much. So there's that. There's racism. There's gender equality. Those are the things where this fits. Tell us a little bit more about this wave as you understand it. I guess this didn't surprise you.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because wave two church history at 42%, I don't think there are a lot of surprises there for people that are in touch with those issues. Nor, as you said, are there big surprises in wave three, church social positions, 33% of people cited this as the primary reason. And by the way, I think that in most churches in the United States, beyond our church, you'd have a similar list. But 33% cited sexual identity as a concern, 27% financial stewardship, 20% said racism, which is also a historical issue, 13% cited gender inequality. And I think most people that are connected to the Latter-day Saint community are not surprised by that list. If there's one thing that surprises some, and it surprises me a little bit, it's that gender equality isn't bigger.
Yeah. I want to ask you something about this last wave, the fourth wave of why people are leaving, and that's spiritual depletion. And this encompasses a sense of people feeling like a kind of spiritual emptiness and a lack of belonging and, you know, a judgmental culture that they see. But the idea of church no longer being spiritually nourishing is interesting. And can I ask it in a kind of crass way? Is it that people just find church these days boring or irrelevant?
Yeah.
To their experience.
I appreciate how you asked that. You know, it's funny. I think there certainly is a segment of Latter-day Saints that would answer the question that way. They would say, man, church is boring. I've done some podcasts with particularly younger people where that tends to be the narrative, right? That we sort of watered things down so much. And I think the church is coming from a good place where they're trying to take less of people's time, more, you know, home-centered church supported, allow people more flexibility locally in what they're doing. And the net result to some feels less rich and meaty and interesting than it has in the past. So I do think what you said is accurate. I think for others, it goes beyond that. It really speaks to not feeling like they're being spiritually fed through their church experience. One individual said to me, I'm in need of the living water and bread of life that the Savior promised, and I just have a hard time getting it from my church experience. Another that I interviewed said, I fell in love with the carpenter of Bethlehem on my mission, and I can't find him in today's church now that I'm home. And so there's a yearning for something deeper, something more meaningful, something more purposeful, something that feels more divine and spiritual, and that sometimes that's hard to grasp or receive in an experience that's feeling a little bit institutional and performative.
I want to ask you just one thing about a section in the book where you write about those, what we know about those who decide to stick around and stay. So as we said, there's that 40% number, right? So which leaves a, you know, 60, basically like 56% who still go to church. 25% of them, they're all in. Like, I believe it. This is great. 13% say, I believe most everything, not everything, but I'm pretty content where I am. But this was really striking. 18% of that group, that 56% who go to church every Sunday, no longer believe the church is what it claims it is, but they still go.
Yes.
How do you explain that?
It's funny. You got to go beyond the surface on this. But once you do, it starts to make sense. And so if you stay on the surface, somebody might say, well, if you remember, we had a conversation a minute ago about this idea of the church being what it claims to be.
Yeah.
And so somebody in this category might say, well, I very carefully evaluated historical information about the church. And based on my evaluation, and by the way, that might have included prayer and scripture study and seeking the Spirit and exercising their powers of reason, they've concluded that the church is not literally the only true church on earth, and it doesn't literally have all the things that we believe it has, like priesthood keys, or they might not believe the Book of Mormon, for example, is a true historical document, literally translated from plates. And so because some people would say, well, once you lose that, why in the world would you stay? Right? Because that's the keystone of our religion. So why in the world wouldn't you just leave? And it's because people's reasons for participating in a faith and in a church community are much more complex than truth claims. So, for example, people stay because they love the community. People stay because they have deep relationships. People stay because they may have a spouse that's a true believing member and they want to participate with their spouse. People stay because they value the teachings of the church, the values, the principle, the way of living, being people that are, you know, of character with good morality. People may stay because they believe the gospel of Jesus Christ is true and good, even if they have questions about the church. And so the idea that when somebody loses their literal belief in the church's truth claims, that there's no other reason to stay and participate just doesn't stand up to the complexity of the real human experience that people are having.
Jeff Strong. His book is called Torn: Why People We Love Are Leaving the Church and What We Can Learn from Them. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Jeff Strong. He's written a book based on the findings of a wide-ranging study of why people are leaving the LDS Church. In the book, he's trying to understand the basics, how many are leaving and why they go. And he thinks he knows the answer. He says it's less to do with doctrine or history and more to do with culture. The book is called Torn. Well, we need to get to a really critical part of the story here, and that is culture. Because if I understand it right, this is what you're identifying as the central issue here. So let's talk about that. What do you mean by the culture here? I mean, how is it that – and how is that different from the other part of the church? You know, there's its doctrines and its principles and its rules for living, but then there's its culture. So what's the difference there?
Yeah, let me give you kind of a textbook definition from one of the world's leading thinkers on culture, and then I'll give you a metaphor that's more useful. So there's a man named Edgar Schein who's considered to be one of the top cultural experts in the world. And he defines culture as artifacts. And what he means by artifacts is visible things that we say and do. You know, Latter-day Saints build temples. We say things like follow the prophet. We do things like serve missions. We also get married in temples. Those are artifacts. Right. Underneath artifacts are values. Values are how we prioritize what we think is important. Things like we value families, we value loyalty, we value commitment to our faith and our religion. Those are values. And then underneath values are underlying beliefs. Those are the doctrinal or theological or cultural things that we believe that our values are then derived from, which ultimately lead to our actions and our behaviors. And so that's Edgar Schein's definition of culture. It's funny because Cale, my son, is a central figure in the book, of course, and I had him read an early manuscript, and he gave me feedback that it wasn't very good, you know? And he said, look, you're pinning this all on culture, but you haven't really defined culture, and you haven't, you didn't make it an arc that runs through the book, and it's just not working well. And so I took the feedback to heart, you know, with a bit of a grimace. And then he said, have you ever looked up the etymology of the word culture? And Doug, I hadn't, and I bet most of your listeners haven't either. And he said, well, look it up. So I did, and I found the etymology of the word culture goes back to the 13th century. It's a Latin word, colere, and it means dirt or soil for the purpose of growing things. And so if you think about it, it makes sense. Soil has two roles. The first role is it has to hold the plant in place by providing protection and stability for the roots. The second role is it has to nourish the plants with minerals, water, and oxygen. And I think that's an excellent metaphor for how culture works in any organization, including our church. And so in our church, the protection and stability side are things like we have a prophet, we have priesthood keys, we have doctrines and theology, we have policies, standards, rules, boundaries, structure, manuals, curriculum. That's all the protection and stability side. The nourishment side is we have the gospel of Jesus Christ, faith, redemption, repentance, covenants, the Holy Ghost, compassion, kindness, service, learning, growth. And so in a healthy culture, you would have an ideal balance of protection and stability to hold the plant in place, but also nourishment. And in our research, and my life experience would agree with this. Our culture tends to lean pretty heavily in the direction of stability and protection, and less heavily in the direction of nourishment. And so when that's the case, plants struggle a bit. They can't grow and they can't thrive. And so that directly contributes to disaffiliation. Now, going back to those four reasons they cite, right? Lifestyle, church history, social issues, and church experience or spiritual depletion. Culture can either amplify those tensions or help relieve them. And so I had a wonderful person I was having a conversation with, and we were talking about the four waves. And she said, well, if the four waves are the reasons people cite for leaving the church, culture might be the riptide that pulls them out to sea if the culture is bad, but it might be the lifesaver on the beach that pulls them out of the surf and resuscitates them if the culture is good. Hmm. And I think that's right. And so there are people that, for example, have significant questions about church history issues, but stay in the church because they're in a place where the culture's working for them. They're having a very positive experience. They have wonderful relationships. They're learning and growing in the church and in the gospel in spite of those historical questions, right? And then there might be a different person that has historical questions, and maybe they meet with a devout parent or a bishop who is not very sympathetic, who mm-hmm. aggressively or defensively seeks to correct them, who makes them feel like their questions are disloyal or perhaps unrighteous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they start to have feelings of not belonging, and that ultimately can contribute to them leaving. And so four waves hitting the beach, culture, if it's healthy, saves you. Culture, if it's not healthy, pulls you out to sea.
You know, Jeff, this is all really important, I think, for members of the church to take in, because one of the assertions that you make in the book is that ordinary church members can influence the culture, and more than they might think. So that's there. But because it seems like you're going to – this is going to actually make a difference in the culture. Common sense says it's going to have to come from the top, or at least some of this.
Sure.
So we were talking earlier about one of the reasons people leave the church, and one of the triggers was that church leaders were perceived as being defensive or misleading, that they were unwilling to apologize when they made mistakes. So what do you say to leaders, general authorities? How do you get them on board? And are you talking to them? Do you think they agree with your concepts?
You know, Doug, it's a really good question. I'm going to be careful about how I answer that, if that's okay.
I kind of figured you would, but go
ahead.
Yeah,
yeah. It isn't Jeff Strong's role to advise church leaders about how they should run the church. And so I don't take that role upon myself, nor do I do it. But what I will tell you is what I pray for. Okay. And what I pray for is that all members, including church leaders, right to the top, right up to President Oaks, that they will be in tune and in touch with the lived realities that all Latter-day Saints are experiencing, and that at a minimum, they will encourage members of the church to entertain the complexity and to work hard to come up with faithful new bottles to hold that new wine. Now, it's no secret that I'd love to have a church where more people could stay. I didn't write the book to recruit people to come back. I do believe if we address the issues I outline in the book that more people will stay, and for me that would be a good thing. I do want to be respectful of people that choose to leave. You know, three of my five children and 61% of my birth family are out, and they would all tell you that I'm very respectful of their decisions, and I'm not trying to fix them or change them. But I pray for and hope for a church community where more and different kinds of Latter-day Saints can feel at home and stay and grow in the gospel in our church and our church community. Hmm. And so that's what I pray for. And so I think part of the key to that is we can't just ignore these issues that are causing people to step away in a culture that tends to amplify those issues instead of relieving them. Now I see the church making efforts, right? The church is certainly being more transparent about its history than it has been in the past. Things like the Joseph Smith Papers, the Gospel Topics essays, the Saints volumes are all intended to help members have a better understanding of some of the issues. And I hope that as we go forward, the church continues to do more and better things in those areas. Back to your question on, you know, culture specifically and the role that members play, I wouldn't want anybody to assume that I don't understand the huge role that senior church leadership plays in creating the culture of the church. But to stop there and say, well, we can't do anything until they change it, I think is not a healthy or a strong mindset. I you know, I'm an old Stephen Covey fan from way back in the day, but Stephen would say, yes, you need to live in your circle of influence, not your circle of concern. And our circle of influence is our own heart, our relationships, our marriages, our immediate families, and maybe our ward. And I think Latter-day Saints really underestimate sometime the difference they can make in those unique areas. We're completely in charge of the culture in our own heart. We're largely in charge of the culture in our marriage and our families, and we have significant opportunity and influence of the culture in our wards. Now, beyond that, not so much. And so my frame of reference here is not a lack of acknowledgement of the role of senior church leaders. it's an invitation to empowerment for church members to exercise the influence that I think they have.
I want to go back to that reaction you had when you first got that email from Cale. And I want to get a sense of how you've changed. And let me ask it this way. Do you still harbor a hope somewhere in the back of your mind that he's going to come back? And for that matter, your son Zach, who also left, and your daughter Samantha, who also left.
Yeah.
Is there somewhere in you, in the active Latter-day Saint, the former mission president and bishop, that like that's the fantasy? I want them back.
Yeah.
Or have you let that go?
You know, I'm 62 years old now, and the culture that I talk about in the book is ingrained in every cell of my body. And even though I probably spent more time researching this and thinking about it and working on it than almost any Latter-day Saint, I'm still influenced and subject to some of those cultural influences. So is there a part of me that might get excited about the possibility that my three children would come back? I think if I'm honest, I would have to say yes. But at the same time, my 13-year journey with this issue has given me a very new bottle. And that new bottle includes a profound respect for my children and their right and capacity to exercise their agency, the choices they're making in their lives, the excitement that I have about the kind of people they are and what they're doing with their lives, in their case, outside of the church. And so it's not clean for me. I guess what I'm saying is maybe I'm torn, right? There's a part of me that says yes. There's a part of me that says, well, when I think about where my family is at now, where I'm at as a Latter-day Saint, where my five children are at, including the three that stepped away, I like who we are and I like where we're at. So there's some complexity here that I'm holding, and that's the best answer I can give you.
Can I impose on you for one more question?
Yes, you can.
So in the book, you tell this story of your daughter, Samantha. She's your oldest. She waited the longest to leave the church, and you relate the story about how it was after you got back from your calling as a mission president that she told you she was leaving. And she wrote this poem, and I wanted you to just say something about that finally. It's called The Other Side. It draws on this image of a river. And those who don't feel like they belong anymore sort of cross over to the other side. But you say crossing over wasn't about leaving the church. It's about leaving fear. And I think fear is an important idea here. Say something about that finally, if you would. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Samantha wrote this poem about the time she stepped away. This would have been back in 2021-ish. And as a gift to her, Cale, who's a musician, turned it into a song. And so he's actually recorded this as a song. The first family vacation that we had together when Sarah and I got home from our mission, Cale performed the song. It's a beautiful song about the inevitability of life and the challenges that it brings to us and how we have to encounter them and take them on and overcome them. And life can be scary, you know. We face incredible uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We face constant adversity and opposition. We're trying to figure out what kind of people we want to be and how to get there. And all of us are looking for meaning that goes beyond kind of the regular and mundane parts of life. And I think they await us, but they await us beyond the concentric circle of our fears. And you have to step beyond those boundaries and take these challenges on in order to have the kind of meaningful, rich, high character life that is possible for all of us. And that's what this poem is about, is not allowing your life to be ruled by the things that make you afraid and being willing to lean in faith and take on those scary things so that you can get to a better place, which she refers to as the other side. It's a principle that that I've learned over my lifetime, and that as I get older, I'm deeply, deeply committed to. I mean, Doug, most of the incredible, positive, successful, transformative experiences that I've had in my life were either profound failures where I had to overcome that, or taking on things that I was terribly afraid of and overcoming that. And I think that's the essence of the poem. I didn't think of it as the way I would end the book, but I was in Dallas with my daughter, Samantha, last fall, and I reread that poem as I was working on the conclusion to the book, and I actually happened to be with her when I decided to include it. So I wrote the last chapter, and then she and I sat down together and I read it to her. And I asked her if she would be okay if I included it in the book and used it as the way to end the book. And she was very honored by that.
Jeff Strong, thank you very much.
You are very welcome. It's such a pleasure.
Jeff Strong, his book is called Torn, Why People We Love Are Leaving the Church and What We Can Learn from Them. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.